It is Monday, November 26, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United Nations Security Council calls an emergency meeting to discuss escalating tension between Russia and Ukraine after a confrontation in the Black Sea. The United States and Mexico pledged tough security after a group of migrants tried to cross the border Sunday. We talked with a reporter who was on the scene.
What they said is that they couldn't wait the months and months that they will have to wait for a number to try to go through the port of entry and to request asylum.
And some runners who dislike trash combine two activities into one. It's called plogging, and we have a report. It's all ahead. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has called on Parliament to consider imposing martial law after Russia Sunday fired on and seized three Ukrainian naval vessels off the coast of Russian annexed Crimea. Poroshenko said martial law would be intended only to strengthen the country's defense capabilities to counter what he called increasing aggression by the Russian Federation. He said Kiev remains committed to regaining Ukrainian territory through political and diplomatic means. Moscow insists the Ukrainian vessels entered its territorial waters illegally, attempted illegal actions, and ignored warnings to stop. It said three Ukrainian sailors were wounded. Both sides have increased their naval presence in the Sea of Azov in recent weeks, a body of water separated from the Black Sea by the Kerch Strait. Relations between the two countries remain tense after Russia annexed Crimea in 2014 and backed separatists fighting in eastern Ukraine, despite the 2015 International Minsk Accords aimed at ending the fighting. Ukraine's foreign ministry called for an international and diplomatic response against Moscow. Robert Manning, a senior security fellow at the Atlantic Council, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, although details remain sketchy, it appears the Kremlin is ratcheting up tensions.
It's clearly an escalation. The fighting in Ukraine has sort of fallen off the front pages, and I don't know that we're any closer to a resolution. It's also been revealed recently that there's an elaborate bypass of sanctions. Trade between Russia and Ukraine is being facilitated through South Ossetia, the succeeded piece of Georgia that Russia dominates. That suggests to me that Putin may be in this for the long haul, and that our hope of realizing the resolution along the lines of the Minsk agreements seem farther than ever.
The European Union in a statement said it expects Russia to restore freedom of passage via the Kerch Strait, urge both sides to act with utmost restraint and to de-escalate the situation. A NATO spokesman issued a similar appeal. Will Russia heed those?
I would like to think that this is a one-off situation. I think that Putin has a situation where he's comfortable with, and I don't think he wants to escalate it. I think the timing of it is interesting. We have a G20 meeting coming up, which for President Trump, whether or not he meets with Putin, we don't know. But this may incline President Trump to meet with him to send a direct message. I don't know. But I do think that it suggests to me that Putin is more inclined to keep Ukraine another frozen conflict rather than to resolve it.
Ukraine, of course, not a member of NATO. Can the alliance do anything about this?
One of the problems is an asymmetry of interest. In other words, Putin, Ukraine is viewed as a vital interest. For the United States, which is a lot more removed, it's an important interest, but not a vital interest. And that was Putin's calculation from the beginning, that the U.S. response would be limited. And so far, he's been proven correct.
Do you see this as a test of President Trump?
To some extent, although, to be fair, I mean, the Trump administration has moved forward in terms of providing arms to, at least defensive arms, to the Ukrainians, and that this may escalate American support for Ukraine as an effort to respond. We just don't know.
Robert Manning of the Atlantic Council. The UN Security Council meets Monday on the latest developments at the request of both Russia and Ukraine. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. General Motors, or also known as GM, will be cutting its North American workforce and closing plants. A violent protest rages in Kabul, and Taliban attacks kill 30 Afghan personnel. A former aide to President Donald Trump will start serving a 14-day jail term, and militant attacks kill 22 people in Somalia. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
In a minute.
A growing body of scientific evidence has suggested that our prehistoric ancestors were responsible for the extinction of a number of large mammal species in Africa. The research suggests that large mammals were becoming extinct at a faster rate than smaller animals, starting around the time when early humans began making and using stone tools and weapons. Among the large, now extinct animals that roamed Africa were gigantic woolly mammoths, along with a variety of early hippos, giraffes, and white and black rhinos. A new study from a group of U.S. scientists suggests that a long-term environmental change, such as dropping atmospheric carbon dioxide, and not our early human ancestors, were mostly responsible for the disappearance of these large, ancient, and mostly plant-eating mammal species beginning about 4.6 million years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, British Prime Minister Theresa May works to persuade Parliament to approve a Brexit deal. Mexican and U.S. authorities are pledging to prosecute those engaging in violence at the border. They spoke after a peaceful march in protest of long asylum processing time Sunday ended with a group of migrants breaking off and trying to cross. U.S. Border Patrol agents responded with tear gas. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Christian Nielsen said Border Patrol personnel were struck by projectiles thrown by caravan members, prompting officers to use the tear gas. From his Twitter account Monday, President Donald Trump threatened to close the U.S. border with Mexico if the neighboring country did not act to stop the migrant caravan. VOA's Celia Mendoza was reporting in Tijuana, Mexico last week. She tells me about the situation that led to the attempted border crossing.
What we saw was the arrival of one of the groups that was in Mexicali, some of the areas close by Tijuana and Mexico. When that group arrived on Wednesday, they were actually starting to plan to walk towards the border between Mexico and the United States. What they said is that they couldn't wait the months and months that they will have to wait for a number to try to go through the port of entry and to request asylum. Most of the younger men, as well as some of the families, said that they wanted to go to the United States border to pressure the government of the United States to request to speak to one of the Border Patrol agents and explain that they need to get a more faster response by the authorities in the United States. Right now, it's about 100 people that they take every day, and it's more than 5,000 that are now established at a shelter at the Unidad Deportiva Benito Juarez in Tijuana. At that point, what we saw was a large movement of people, including children and women. They were walking towards the border. The area where they concentrated is called El Chaparral, which is one of the pedestrian crossings between Mexico and the United States, and also that has one of the vehicle exits between the United States and Mexico. Now, as far as we understand, the group breaks out of the peaceful protest and tried to go through one of the pedestrian crosses, in this case, El Chaparral, and tried to go by foot into the United States using one of the car lanes that comes from San Diego to Tijuana. That prompted immediately the authorities, especially in the United States, to close the border and the bridge, which is San Isidro. This is one of the largest, if not the largest, crossings in the world, which has thousands of people daily crossing, millions a year. One of the things that we saw that was similar is the agents from Border Patrol using their helicopters to monitor what's happening in the other side of the border. We saw it in last week. They were flying over the shelter as well as the border area, and they continue to do it. They even send messages, audio messages from the helicopters. And yesterday, as the crowd broke out and everything started, we heard from our partners on the ground that they can hear the helicopters flying. Military moves in the other side of the border to protect the members of the CBP, which is the Border Patrol, who then, in a rare action, launched some of the tear gas that was received in the other side of the border. According to the people, it was a chaotic scene for a few minutes until things kind of went back to normal. People retrieved and went back to the shelter.
Has there been close cooperation between U.S. and Mexican officials in this regard?
Absolutely. What we have seen is the possibility of the helicopters from the United States to fly over Mexican territory. We believe that that's something that has been arranged. The federal police, the Mexican federal police, which is the entity in charge of the border, has been there trying to create their own barriers, not only with the anti-riot equipment for some of their officers, but also they had put physical barricades to try to stop the migrants to even get to the fence between the U.S. and Mexico. And just right now, we have word that the Mexico has deported 98 migrants who tried to enter the U.S., and this is some of the efforts that is being done also by the mayor of Tijuana. The mayor of Tijuana has been extremely vocal about the burden that it means for his town to take the migrants, but also he on Twitter, he sent a message saying that he does not want to jeopardize the relationship that Tijuana has with the United States because of the members of the caravan. His name is Juan Manuel Gastelum, and he said exactly that he is not going to allow the bilateral relationships be fractured because of the wrongdoing of the migrant caravan. And this is something that we also have heard from some members of the community, is one woman has become the face of the protest against the migrants. Her name is Paloma Zuniga. She calls herself Paloma for Trump. And she wears a red hat similar to President Trump's campaign hat, which says, "Make Tijuana Great Again." And she has been in this protest saying that Mexicans do not tolerate this kind of activity, that they want them to go back to their country, and she does not want the government of Tijuana to keep paying for their shelter and food. So we have seen a situation that is growing and brewing within Tijuana as well as other places in Mexico. We understand that the mayor, Castellum, has requested federal funds from the Mexican government, which is changing president in the next few days, and that will be very key to handle this situation. As of right now, the border is open after hours of being closed due to the scaffold, as we can call it, that was registered yesterday.
VOA Celia Mendoza reporting from New York. On Monday, British Prime Minister Theresa May began a two-week race to convince the British public and a skeptical parliament to back the Brexit deal she struck with the European Union. May returned from Brussels with a divorce agreement approved by the 27 other EU leaders. European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said Britain cannot expect to get a better deal if its parliament rejects the agreement. Jamie Detmer in London tells me about May's latest effort to promote the Brexit deal.
The issue really over this Brexit deal, and I also emphasize, there's a withdrawal agreement, which is a transitional period, and then there's a political outline that they've laid out for a future deal, which will take many years to negotiate as well. But the whole package looks like it will be voted down by Parliament. She's busy trying to sell the deal that has been approved by her and the European Union leaders. It was approved on Sunday, has written an open letter to the public, hoping that they'll put pressure on lawmakers. But the deal is not popular. All the opposition parties are against, including an opposition party that the Conservatives, her government, relies on for their majority in the House because it's a minority government. And she's got at least 91 of her own lawmakers deeply opposed to the deal. But she's ploughing on. And of course, she survived alarms before. Maybe there's a possibility the deal can go through because people are scared if it doesn't go through, then Britain could crash out without any kind of deal, which would have really profound economic consequences for Britain. But at the moment, the signs are that this deal is not going to be approved by Parliament. And then the question is, what if? What happens then?
When is it likely the House of Commons will vote on this?
It's early December. We haven't got an exact date yet. It's being called a meaningful vote. It will probably be around December the 10th or within the next, in 2 to 3 weeks' time. So she's basically got that time to try to get a majority in the House of Commons. But she's got some very powerful political foes, many on her own benches.
And what are the reasons that the opponents to this deal, what are the reasons that they give for objecting to it?
Well, quite amazingly, this deal has united Leavers, those who want to break away from the European Union, with Remainers, who obviously want to stay inside the European Union. They've got different reasons for opposing. But, you know, fundamentally, it comes down to this transition period, which could be 3-4 years, when Britain signs up for the customs union. It has so-called frictionless trade, but it has to obey the bloc's rules, regulations and laws without any influence about shaping them. At the same time, the deal treats Northern Ireland differently from the rest of the UK. And as one goes forward, that divergence would increase. So a lot of Conservatives and Unionists in Northern Ireland are opposed because they believe it weakens, diminishes the ties between Belfast and London. Others, the Remainers in particular, are opposed because they don't think it ties Britain enough to the EU. They want to see a Norway option whereby they join another body which is connected to the European Union, but then they have to accept freedom of movement, that anyone from Europe can go and live and work in the UK. So those are the fundamental disagreements about it. It really puts the EU more in the driving seat than Britain, and that's what's alarming to those who oppose the deal.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been quoted as saying she was relieved that the bloc had made it to this point, and then she said, "I think we managed to make a diplomatic piece of art."
Well, interesting comments, yes. I mean, it's been 2 years of torturous negotiations. The document, the actual exit agreement, is 585 pages long. The outline for a future arrangement after Britain fundamentally leaves in 2-3 years' time is much shorter. It's only 26 pages. But, you know, behind all the talking up of the deal by European Union leaders, particularly yesterday in Brussels, on Sunday, there is nervousness about where this is going. And I understand, I've talked to European and British officials, behind the scenes, there are some plan B ideas that if this is voted down, there could be an extension before Britain officially has to leave on March the 29th next year. They could extend that deadline. There are quite a lot of cross-party maneuvering going on in the House of Commons to try to get another vote which would allow them to negotiate a Norway-style deal. So people are thinking about contingency plans, including European Union leaders, even when they're saying this is now a done deal and it can't be unpicked and we can't consider anything else. So we're still living, as ever, in this interminable Brexit process with more trials and tribulations ahead and still great unpredictability.
Jamie Dettner reporting from London. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Many athletes have been doing it for a long time without even knowing it's now a fitness trend. It's called plogging, a combination of jogging and picking up. And what's being picked up is trash. The Swedes are credited with starting the trend, and now it's spreading in the United States. As Faiza Al-Masri tells us, many athletes in Washington seem to like multitasking with a group of like-minded runners and keeping their city clean and beautiful. Faith Lapidus narrates.
A sunny and breezy day is perfect for plogging.
I didn't even know it was a thing, really.
Jeff Horowitz, a personal trainer at Vita Gym in Washington, has been plogging for a while.
This is just my personal ethic, where I would go for a run, and if I happened to see a piece of garbage laying around and it was within reach, it was kind of a little test of mine to see if I can grab it and throw it in a nearby trash can without stopping. And that way, I thought it gave me a little bit of exercise, a little focus to my run, and it helped clean up the neighborhood. And then I come to find out this has actually become an international movement, that there are people all around the world now doing this.
Getting ready to plog is similar to getting ready to jog.
We usually start with doing some bodyweight squats, some calisthenics, some balance work, and then just reviewing exactly what we're going to do and, of course, the route we're going to take. The gloves are important. You want to make sure that this is going to be healthy for you, even if you have good intentions. You never know what you'll find. It might be broken glass, medical waste.
There are rules for plogging.
You can't just suddenly bend over in front of someone else. It'd become like a Three Stooges event and everyone would fall over. And then you want to make sure that you kind of cover a little bit of different territory. People kind of naturally fall into that role. So if I'm a little bit more to the curbside, I'll look towards the gutter. And someone else a little bit close to the hedges, they fall into picking up there. So you get a rhythm going between people. Without sometimes even agreeing to it, you all fall into your role.
Sports event organizer Dana Allen finds plogging interesting, but admits she doesn't do it all the time.
When I'm training seriously for a marathon, I probably wouldn't be as inclined to stop regularly when I'm running because I'm focused on a certain goal. But then there's other days I'm out and just sort of more relaxed running and just having fun. And that would be a situation where I might be more inclined to do it. Sometimes we get groups together on a Saturday or a Sunday. We go for a run, we'll pick up some garbage, then we'll actually go for brunch after and we'll kind of make a little bit of an event of it.
Encouraging more people to plog helps raise awareness about Washington's litter problem, says Julie Lawson, who works with the mayor's Clean City office.
When the street looks bad and it's dirty, you're going to feel bad about the neighborhood, about the community, may even feel less safe because of that. So if we are all doing our part and picking it up, it's very easy to help beautify it, help build those social connections. You get to know your neighbors. You get to feel some social responsibility and community feel when you do this.
Plogging also helps advance a citywide fitness initiative.
Fit DC is Mayor Bowser's initiative to get DC back to number one in the country as the fittest city in the nation. And as part of that, our Department of Parks and Recreation put on a couple of plogging events, and we look forward to continuing to support that.
Hazel Washington says participating in plogging events makes him feel better.
It would clear out a lot of space for me, and I'm rewarded myself.
Plogger Allen hopes one day there won't be a need for plogging.
I would just hope people would think twice before dropping their garbage on the ground. We have receptacles, seems like, every block. So it's easy to put your garbage in the trash cans. I just think people should think about it a little bit more and be cognizant of keeping the city as beautiful as possible.
That's the message ploggers hope people on the street will get when they see them running and picking up trash. For Faiza El-Masri in Washington, Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thank you, Faith. That is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA1, the voice of America.